Oh, welcome. This is a really deep subject. I'll do my best to do something with it. Old age, decay, and death is everywhere for everybody. There are four universal sufferings that all humans participate in. Birth, and it's no accident that birth entails the child coming out screaming and the mother screaming, you know, because that's suffering. Old age, sickness, and death are the other universals. And we've all been sick. We know what it is. We simply bear it, just like we bear the other sufferings in this samsara. In this culture, old age and death are a little bit pushed aside. They're a little bit taboo, or they were. Now things are changing pretty fast, and people are beginning to realize that death is a part of life. And actually, every instant is a little death. If you think of the rising and falling of dharmas, if you think of the dharmas, the individual constituents of reality, I think of them as atoms of experience. And these arise out of the emptiness in groups. So these clusters of dharmas, call them molecules of experience, arise in an instant. They have a small duration, 10,000th of a second maybe, and then they dissolve back into emptiness. And then the next moment, a new set of dharmas arises, a new set of experiences, and that lasts for a little moment, and then that decays into emptiness. And the good news behind all this is that every empty moment between these moments of experience is the Buddha nature, the clear light mind. It's always there. Eternity is only to be found in the present moment, and it's always there. It's just that we're not usually there for it, because we have minds that are too occluded. So every moment we miss the perception of the clear light mind because of our obscurations, and this is motivation to practice. We want to thin the veils so that we open to the greater reality. And it takes a bit of chipping away at our obscurations to do that. So that's the situation. Every moment is a birth and a death. And we continue living as if that wasn't the case. Impermanence, when Lord Buddha first thought of it, or first enunciated the principle, he was in a world where things changed only slowly. The grandparents had the same experience as the grandchildren, so they could better guide them. And now things have speeded up to the extent that our grandchildren are having a totally different experience than what we had growing up, because the world has changed. It's different. That's impermanence. And it just keeps accelerating. And now another wrinkle, the acceleration. It's kind of counterintuitive, but time seems to speed up as we age. So I think of it this way. At conception, we're moving the fastest. Everything is the freshest. You know, cell division, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. Really rapid. And even at that time, it starts to slow. As the embryo is formed, the cell division is slower. As the fetus is formed, it's slower yet. And then there's birth and the suffering of birth and the first breath. And then a new cycle begins. But the growth, even though it's rapid, is a lot slower than it was at conception. And the growth continues to slow as we get older. So by the time we're 18, we've mostly stopped growing physically. I guess there's another few years of growth. And then it starts slowing down some more. And even in youth, the decay begins. you know, the gradual loss of energy, of speed. It happens so gradually that no youth notices that. You know, you won't find young people that think a lot about death unless they're in that mental space. It doesn't seem real, even at maturity. By maturity, things have slowed enough that you notice, boy, those kids are fast. You know, because things have slowed down a little bit. And yet we're still heedless. We don't notice that that's happened, or we push it aside, not realizing, ah, this is a first taste of old age at maturity. But we continue with the hallucination that things are permanent, that it could go on like this forever. It's a natural hallucination of the human mind. Well, we gradually wake up to the fact that it isn't going on forever, and that our time is limited. And not only that, because of the slowdown, you know, as our body continues to slow down, then our reflexes get slow, which is why 80-year-olds have difficulty with driving. Because it takes longer to think a thought. But then there's the wrinkle. You think a thought, and it takes a longer time, so there are fewer thoughts in a day, fewer experiences in a day. So the day seems to go along faster. And the older we get, the faster the days go. So the sad fact is we have even less time left than we think we do, because our memory is in the past. The imprints of the events of the past kind of fill up the mind. And meanwhile, everything is slowing down, so there's less and less time in a day. And, you know, you add on top of that the acceleration due to technology, and we're really, you know, it's a wonder we're not dizzy, because it's changing that fast. So finally, the slow ends in a stop, and that's clinical death. I wrote up the handout as usual. It'll be posted on the Nalanda website, and we're going to put a link to that document in the description for the video. So it is available. I'm following it more or less according to the structure that I wrote. Okay, the discontinuities of experience and the clear light of death being related to the clear light at every moment. The clear light of death arises after the death is complete and before the bardo starts. So it's that interval in there. And it's so radiant that most people pass out during that time. Just as we don't perceive the clear light every moment, every waking moment, because we're obscured. But the advice is, after you're dead, follow the brightest light you can stand. Because there are some very bright lights out there, and the clear light is the brightest of the lot. So we tend to shy away from that and want to go for a softer light, which gets us into rebirth in whatever world we're to occupy next. There's another kind of death going on. Well, several kinds, actually. Just as people experience birth, old age, sickness, and death, so do worlds and civilizations and species. And we're in a place where not only are we personally, physically dying, our civilization is dying, and our world is endangered. So we're looking at the death of species, Extinction 6, they call that, because there were the extinction of the dinosaurs in the past, the Permian extinction where it became hothouse Earth. So this has happened before. This is the sixth time around, apparently. It's human-triggered, and it's a major climate crisis. It's an emergency that is invisible to most people. But that's possibly the death of our species. So if you think about it, that's a different kind of death. This is the death of humankind. And it's hard to come to terms with that. I have very mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, look at us. We're rapacious, we're heedless, we're destructive, we're parasitical. You know, does a species like that have a right to live? Then turn that around and say, okay, we made great art, we made great music, we made great philosophy. All of that is going to be gone if the species dies. So it's a different kind of loss than our personal loss when we die. And apparently, and I've noticed this already in my own life, things that I used to care about passionately, I don't much care anymore. You know, things that I used to delight in, I still enjoy, but the enjoyment is somehow a little bit blunted. And that continues on into old age. Personally, I'm at the onset of old age, so I see these signs, but I haven't experienced the depth of old age. I see people out there. I see an old man, old woman going to the supermarket, and every step is slow and measured because their body hurts if they move it the other way, right? So that's something I have yet to experience. But the signs are there. If the Christians are right, it's Armageddon. If they have it wrong, it's still possibly the end of the biosupport system in the world as we know it. In fact, that's practically guaranteed. So in Hindu lore, Indian cosmology, you call the death of a world system pralaya. And in Buddhist cosmology, pralaya comprises a water disaster, a wind disaster, and a fire disaster. And these are so thorough, not that we have any water disasters like the hurricane sits over Houston and dumps a lot of water on it. We haven't had any wind disasters. Again, the hurricanes got bigger. And fire disasters, we could get nuked. That would be nice. We certainly have fire disasters happening every summer. You know, as the forests dry out and things are ready to go up in flames. And since turning that around involves a mobilization greater than that of World War II, in terms of let's get on this and make it happen, where's the evidence that that is happening? So that makes our death of the species even more probable. Because the longer we wait, the harder it gets to turn it around. And we don't know enough planetary engineering to turn it around rightly. And we could put some minds to work on it. We could put some resources to work on it. But it doesn't look like we're gonna right now. So the danger goes on. The overall picture of world systems and the rise and fall. In the Hindu tradition, our current era is called Kali Yuga. Kali is the destructive goddess. She's the consort of Shiva, the destroyer of worlds. And it's her time, you know, a time of destruction. So it starts out in this model. There's a golden age. Golden age lasts for a very long time. Apparently, our golden age was a stone age. They didn't have writing yet. They didn't need it. Whatever the golden age was, it's long gone. And what happens is after a while, the Dharma decays a little bit and it becomes a silver age. Okay, that's still pretty good. Think of it as a four-legged stool. You know, when it's the golden age, all four legs are solid. When it's the silver age, it's three-legged. It's still a solid figure, but it's somehow less than the golden age. Then it goes to bronze age and it continues to decay until it goes to the Iron Age, and that's the age we're in, the Kali Yuga. And then there's two models in the mythology. One of them says after the destruction of civilization and the world happens at the end of the Kali Age, it goes right back to a golden age, in a total transformation. That's certainly in our current mythology, the Aquarian Age, the New Age, when things will be suddenly all right, and so on like that. That's one model. Swami Yukteswar came up with an alternate model, and he said, well, you get to the bottom of Kali Yuga, like, say, during the Roman Empire, when it almost crystallized in that empire, and then it starts into the ascending Kali. And then it goes into the ascending Bronze Age and the ascending Silver Age, back to the Golden Age. And then the Golden Age lasts a very long time, and then it begins to decay again. That's the said to be the cycle of civilizations. So whatever age we're actually in, it sure looks like Kali to me. We've got plenty of iron going on. It could be the ascending Bronze already. Anyway, wherever we are, it's not a very good place in relation to the Golden Age. And we can wish for one re-arising. Okay. Now, I did some brainstorming about the sufferings of individual old age. So these are not, you know, well-formed outline or anything. But on the basis of what I observed and what I've experienced, one of the signs of aging is increasing frailty. Our strength is simply not as great. I mean, anybody that's middle-aged knows that those strapping youths are a lot stronger physically than we are already. And as you get older, it gets worse. I have vitality swings. I'll get up in the morning and, oh, no energy. Get up the next day, wow, I've got some energy. So it fluctuates. But the frailty is ongoing and it increases. I remember going on a walk and there was the neighbor lady, she has since died. She was out with her walker and she sat down on a curb. She couldn't get up. You know how it is, how hard it is for old people to stand when they're sitting, especially if they're in a low seat. So she was stranded there on the curb, and I happened to come along, and of course I helped her up, and she went on with her walker. And I don't want to be in that state. I already am careful when I get up from a seat. So this ongoing decay gradually influences our life for the worse. Another thing that I remember seeing, a decreasing range of social circulation. I'm the old guy in the mix, right? And very often there's something going on. The younger people are too busy to add in. You know, the old people kind of get skipped because they're so slow. So the world speeds up around me, and I'm sitting there kind of watching it. And that decreasing range of circulation continues. And they say everyone dies alone, even if the room is full of people. And I saw that with my mother. She connected for the last time about 2-3 hours before she died. And her mind was moving really fast. Okay, there's a last time for everything. Shrinking opportunity, that we get already when we're 60 years old. My brother had to get a new job, and he had all the qualifications, but they wouldn't hire him because he was old. You know, the 30-somethings that run the personnel department, you know, they see age as a total liability. You know, in the old days, there was respect for elders, and the elders participated. Even in third world countries, I saw a lovely picture of a guy in extreme old age sitting in a chair in the middle of a third world house, and all the activity was going on around him, and he was just sitting there in the kitchen, not exactly out of it. He was participating in his own way. We don't do that in this culture. We warehouse the old people in rest homes, as they're called. And the result is there's more isolation in age than there needs to be because of the social structure. But the overall condition, the karmic condition of being in a world that's impermanent and where everything decays from its original freshness into something like dead. You know, that's a nature of this world. We need to incorporate that in our understanding and live as the best that we can in each moment, because we have a limited number of moments. And again, if you stay mindful in the moment, there's a lot of joy in that. And keeping death in mind, in Buddhism and in quite a few other traditions, it's recommended to keep the fact of your own incipient death in mind. You know, not pushing it away, saying, okay, I'm going to die. I'm apparently not dying right now. But the irony is we don't know when we're going to die. We don't know how we're going to die, even though it's certain that we will die. So we've got all that stuff to deal with. What else did I write? Oh, yeah. Shrinking opportunity. Loneliness and isolation. That, again, is especially acute in Western cultures where we ignore the old people. Sense of abandonment. Everybody feels that once in a while. And again, when you're sitting alone with your thoughts and there's nothing going on, nobody expected, nothing on the schedule, you can feel abandoned. You can just feel relieved that there's nothing you have to do. It just depends on how you approach the experience. But there's a lot of alone time. Another thing, loss of friends and family to death. You know, every time a relative of mine dies, I had a friend die just recently, suddenly. He was at a Zen center working in the garden under the hot sun, and he was the kind of person that pushes himself all the time. And he collapsed in the hot sun, and they couldn't revive him. You know, he was 50-some. And so before we die ourselves, we find our loved ones dying, usually. And then the shrinking range indicates less travel. I'm not probably going to Bali anytime soon. I did go to Sacramento on the train, but that was because my cousin died. So, you know, the death of others is a factor in our own aging. Patronizing treatment by the young. I get that every once in a while. And it's partly that young people, it's like the way we deal with the disabled. We don't know how to deal with them. We don't know what they need. You know, luckily I had some contact with wheelchair people, so I know approximately what I need to do. But they tend to assume that you're senile and weak. And it depends on the person, right? I might be senile, but I'm not weak. Or I might be really frail, but I'm not senile. And they don't differentiate among the different phases of old age decay and death. So there's a certain patronizing quality to the way the young interact with the old. What else have we got? Fewer events in a day. That's the speeding up that I talked about. Susceptibility to disease. You know, stuff that in your youth is merely a setback can be deadly if you're old. Flus. That sort of thing, pneumonia especially. So we're more susceptible to disease as we get older. Decreasing range of physical circulation. I get that already, and I'm a young oldster, right? I saw that with my father. He loved to take walks, and he'd walk around the neighborhood with his cane. And pretty soon he'd walk to the corner by the arterial and turn around and come back. And then later he'd walk to the near corner. And pretty soon he didn't leave the house. After a while, he could barely leave his chair. You know, he had three places where he existed, on that chair, on the commode, and in bed. And he would go between those three places. and all of that kind of thing is in our future, but we don't know what part of the mix we're going to get. So that's the suffering of old age and decay. The Buddhist teachings about physical death are pretty universal. I wrote, as physical death approaches, the outer dissolution begins. Sensorium is confounded. We no longer are able to process sense contacts. We can hear and see, but no longer understand or recognize what is sense. Now, these are the phases of the incipient death, so we haven't experienced that, except maybe in meditational glimpses. So the first thing that happens is that four elements dissolve one by one. When the earth element dissolves, then you can't stand up anymore. And it feels like there's a great weight pressing on you, and it's even an effort after a while to lift the eyelids. That's the earth element going away. And there's a sign of it. It's called a shimmering mirage. Then the water element goes away, and when it recedes, no more control of bodily fluids. Incontinence, nose runs, eyes discharge, and then everything dries out, and the dying become thirsty. I remember when Larry was dying, they had a little sponge in a glass of water. And you apply the sponge to his mouth, and you get a little bit of moisture that way. You know, and in that case, he had had a stroke, so he couldn't talk anymore. But you could tell he was in there by his eyes. He was still awake. Okay, then when the water element goes away, the feeling skanda dissolves, just as the form skanda dissolved when the earth went away. Then the fire element goes away. Oh, the water element, the sign of this phase is haze with whirling wisps of smoke. And this is the traditional description of the hallucination that you get when that element dissolves. Again, how they got this information, I wonder. Apparently somebody came back or described their dying as it happened. It's hard to say, but I believe them. So then the fire element, and all warmth ebbs from the body. People get cold. And now that's a movie cliche. The pirate gets shot. I'm so cold as he dies. Right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's why. It's because the fire element has gone away. Our breath is cold. We cannot digest anything. Perception skanda dissolves. The mind swings between clarity and confusion. The sign of this is shimmering red sparks dancing above an open fire, like fireflies. Again, we haven't experienced that, but apparently that's what happens. Then the air element begins to dissolve into space. Breathing becomes more and more difficult. We pant and labor to breathe. Our out-breaths become longer, and the samskara skanda dissolves. Our mind now becomes bewildered, unaware of the outside world. Everything becomes a blur, hallucinations and visions. A flaming torch or a lamp with a red glow is the sign. Then the breathing stops, and we are clinically dead. The energy withdraws into the heart, and the heart is still slightly warm. Now, they say that after clinical death, that there is a fourfold inner dissolution that happens after that. And so a kind of internal breathing, a kind of internal respiration continues after the breathing has stopped. And as the energy withdraws into the heart, a kind of internal respiration continues and goes on about 20 minutes, traditionally the length of time it takes to eat a whole meal. So as long as this inspiration, respiration continues, we go through four more dissolutions. Fifth dissolution, 80 concept, and I have to read this because I haven't experienced it and haven't memorized it. The 80 conceptions are gross and subtle thought states and emotions dissolve. Winds in the right and left channels above the heart level enter the central channel at the top of the head. Signs of this stage were a flickering butter lamp. Then clear vacuity filled with the white appearance. I've seen that in the yogic text too. They talk about the white appearance, the red increase, the black near attainment, and the clear light mind. So these are the phases of the inner dissolution, as well as the phases of yogas, which capitulate the process in order to reach the clear light mind. So for fifth dissolution, then, a clear vacuity filled with white appearance. On the sixth dissolution, mind of white appearance dissolves. Upper and lower winds gather at the heart and enter the drop at the heart, the indestructible drop, the bindu. Signs of vacuity filled with black darkness, swooning. Eighth dissolution, mind of black near attainment dissolves. All winds dissolve into the very subtle life force in the indestructible drop at the heart. The mind of the clear light of death dawns. And then once that inner dissolution is complete and the mind of black near attainment dissolves, then you have the full clear light. And again, they yogically recapitulate those phases of death without physically dying in order to reach the clear light mind. Now, the usual Tibetan story, which I have been buying into and still buy into, eight forms of dissolution, eight phases of dissolution, followed by the rising of the clear light mind, that's called the Chikai Bardo. It's the first of the three bardos of death. So the clear light mind arises. Most people pass out during that because the light is too bright. So we want to accustom ourselves to spiritual light so that we can stay awake during that time. In fact, philosophers say that philosophy is really a preparation for dying. And that's because we want to stay awake. We want to die consciously. We want to be there for it, and it's hard to do. So we practice a lot. Anyway, once the Chikai Bardo has passed, then there arises what's called the Chernyid Bardo. And that's where the 100 peaceful and wrathful deities emerge. And what it apparently is, the mind has separated from the body. You know, the mind and emotions have separated from the body. So that body anchor no longer exists. And people that have meditated full well know that the mind is crazy. It's like a cascade, a waterfall. And to get used to that flow of the mind while we're alive and to be able to slow it down is a very good thing. Because during the bardo, every thought that you have manifests as an appearance. So I think of Hong Kong, oh, I'm in Hong Kong now. And I think of Australia, I'm in Australia the next instant. You know, the mind is all over the place. And in the bardo, there's no body to anchor it. So the experience goes wherever the mind goes. And this goes on through the apparition of these 100 peaceful and wrathful deities. That's the Tibetan cultural view of what it is. If you look at the Egyptian Book of the Dead, they have different images, but a similar kind of pattern. The death process is a series of phases. In Egypt, there are gates. You have to have a mantra to open each gate. And they say that the sun of the pharaoh sets in the west, goes under the earth, or into the river galaxy in the sky, two versions. And the bark of the sun then proceeds through the underworld and encounters various dangers and overcomes them. So the overall structure is about the same, but the images are completely different. Now, in the Tibetan version, the peaceful deities arise, and at each stage you can recognize your Buddha nature and exit from that bardo, but it takes recognition. When you see lovely Amitabha, you realize, this is a projection of my own Buddha mind. And then if we don't recognize all through those parts of the bardo, then we go into the wrathful deities and things get horrendous. And each wrathful deity is a reflection of one of our faults, character defects, if you will. And so we go through all of that and then go into the Sipa bardo, the bardo of becoming. And that's where you see lights representing places of rebirth. And again, the principle is go for the brightest light you can stand, because the duller lights lead to the worst worlds. That's the story. And I somehow prefer that story to the one-shot heaven or hell forever. It makes more sense to me. It just keeps happening until we overcome it and transcend it. And with that, I think we have transcended the time, so we'll quit. Thank you very much. Now we got Q&A or comments or whatever.
I wonder if we study the 100 peaceful deities, reinforce them in our mind, if that helps us train for that time.
It might. Yeah, there's an initiation for the 100 deities. And in Nyingma, one called Vigukya Garbha, the wrinkle there is I did have that initiation. And at the end of the initiation, the Rinpoche said, well, you have the opening, the initiation. Now, if you can find somebody that's going to explain this to you, you're very fortunate. And I haven't yet so far, but I'm looking. Because there's a lot more to it than I perceive. And having had the initiation, that all that is an opening. You know, so if I try to go through the door, I need a little more insight into the process. But yeah, there is now a complete edition of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, published by the Dalai Lama and Tipton Jinpa. I'm not sure who all was involved. I started with the Evans Wentz book, which is considered obsolete, but it was sufficient. And that's a small part of the Bardo Todo. That's the Bardo Todo, the liberation by hearing. And the Book of the Dead has 11 parts. So reading the Book of the Dead, Chögyam Trungpa and Francesca Fremantle did a translation of the Book of the Dead, which has the Bardo Todo in it. And that's pretty basic. But if you want to really get into it, get the full edition. It's a red hardback.
Yeah, I guess struggling here. So acceptance of our own death is one difficulty. The ego grasping, thinking we're going to persist forever and all these kinds of things. We just went over a bunch of stuff about how to learn to realize that, to view it differently. And then I see a lot of people struggling about the bigger issue, and that's the thing about accepting the extinction of our species, for example. That's very contemporary. And it seems to me it's the same thing. If we can't accept our own demise, it's clear that we can't hardly accept the demise of humanity. But species almost always perish in a couple hundred million years on this planet, given mass extinctions as well. So is that some kind of group grasping assumption that we will live forever as a species? It doesn't wash in biology.
No, it's not possible in biology. No. Everything that's born in a world like this experiences impermanence and then death. Everything. You know, the Buddha Dharma is no exception. There's prophecies out there saying, well, Shakyamuni Buddha taught the full Dharma, and for 500 years, the cream of the Dharma was available. The arhats were many. And after 500 years, there were no more arhats. They'd used up the cream, so they start on the milk. And you have two 500-year periods of that which appears to be the Dharma, but there's something missing. So this is the era where temples are built, great art is made, there's mass movements in the direction of the religion, but the core of the Dharma is somehow, not all of it got transmitted to that age. And then we get to the Dharma ending age, which is the one we're in. And the Dharma ending age, it's a situation where, to use the mythology, there's a great king who has a huge kingdom, wealth, armies, cattle, and he offers half of his kingdom for one four-line stanza. And when nobody can come up with one, the Dharma is definitively dead. And, you know, again, that's mythology, but what it is every venerable institution, even the Buddha Dharma itself, is because it's born in samsara, it's going to die in samsara. And that's just how things are. And it's ironic, but getting okay with that makes us happier. You know, I've been working on this a while, and I find my level of contentment has increased. You know, the doom and gloom of pessimistic Buddhism, it just doesn't work that way. It's like we accept the reality as it is and carry on, and somehow that lightens our burden, makes us, you know, less weighed down by circumstance in a way. You know, we transcend the circumstance, and that's the hope. That's why we keep practicing.
Bob, can you comment on the other Buddhas and what the transition was between, you know, do we go through dark kalpas and things like that?
Oh, yeah, that's an intricate set of mythological ideas. This particular kalpa is called the Bhadra kalpa, the extensive kalpa, because in this kalpa, kalpa is a very long span of time. Within this kalpa, in this world system, there are going to be 1,000 Buddhas. And Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth of these 1,000 Buddhas. So what happens is the Buddha arrives, attains full enlightenment, teaches the Dharma. The Dharma goes on for a while, decays. When the Dharma dies, a new Buddha comes. And I don't know how long the gap is supposed to be between the death of the Dharma and the arising of the next Buddha. But then the next Buddha arrives, and this is going to go on for 1,000 Buddhas in this long kalpa, in this huge age. And there are some ages, some kalpas, where there's no Buddha at all. That's called an empty kalpa. And there's some kalpas where there are fewer than 1,000 by quite a bit. So this is a lucky kalpa in that there are 1,000 Buddhas going to be born in it. And, you know, these mythological figures have meaning, not to take them literally, but to understand what meaning they're pointing at.
What do you mean by, on the third page, you say after clinical death, the inner disillusion begins, and then you say the internal respiration continues.
Yeah.
They usually have you out of the hospital bed by 20 minutes. After death.
Yeah, I suppose it can happen sooner than 20 minutes. And then there's another thing not covered too, and that's what happens with sudden death, you know, or early death. Different process, all of these things get telescoped. So all these dissolutions would happen a lot faster in the case of a sudden death. You know, the advantage of the long, slow death is you got time to assimilate each phase. You know, if you die suddenly, then you have a greater shock, and it's harder to connect with a clear light.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot of different ways to die in that sense.